They used to own everything, and in a way they still do. The media, the banks, the NGOs, the international organizations, and almost all the governments and corporations in the world. And with that, of course, they also own the armies, the loans, the money supply, the credit ratings, the narrative, the propaganda, the factories, the food supply. They control international trade and international law. But their most powerful weapon is the control of the truth. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, and we have another piece from Bitcoin Magazine today. I've got a couple of really fun things I think lined up very soon, so do not forget to subscribe, and also don't forget to bump me up on Fountain.fm if you like the show. Fountain is a lightning-enabled app that does the value-for-value model and lets you boost and, you know, share clips and a lot of fun stuff, but I would like to have I would love Bitcoin Audible to be at the top of those charts, because who loves Bitcoin and Lightning more than me, than us, than our crew? Come on. The top of that leaderboard needs to be a Bitcoin show. But that is not what this episode is about. This episode is actually the cover story for the new version, or the new issue of Bitcoin Magazine, the actual magazine. And they published it in the, I published it online, and it is by Nayib Bukele. So it's by the president of El Salvador talking about their, essentially addressing the IMF's and the mainstream media's narrative about their suddenly decimated credit rating and how they're going to default and the amount of smear that they have put towards El Salvador to position their rather small investment in Bitcoin from the grand scheme of things as something that has destroyed the nation. And I think he has a very, very good point. And I get into the guy's take, and I kind of try to take the perspective of somebody who does not like to, you know, hold up politicians on a pedestal. And I do not like taking them at their word. But he makes a very, very good point, and I think there is a powerful thread of truth that I think is worth unraveling. And also, it's really just kind of incredible to see the actual statistics and how they are portrayed by the mainstream media. So I don't want to lead too much. Let's just go ahead and get into the article. It's a short one, and then we have a guy's take after. Real quick, I just want to say thank you to Swan Bitcoin for always doing such great analysis and for holding strong through these crazy times, and for always being there to automatically purchase and automatically send me my coins. And just in case I was stupid enough to have a bunch of funds on FTX, if I listened to Swan, I would have gotten out before everything imploded. I don't even know how you put a price on that. So check them out at swanbitcoin.com/guy. And a thank you to Fold for being the pay me sats for my fiat life that I still have to do. But when the price dips like this, I get mega sats back, and it feels really good. And then lastly, to CoinKite and the Cold Card Hardware Wallet and all of their amazing Bitcoin security devices and the Block Clock, all the amazing things that they have over there to keep my keys safe and protect my monetary sovereignty. Links to all these guys in the show notes with discounts and special goodies. With that, let's get into today's read. And it's titled, Stop Drinking the Elite's Kool-Aid by Nayib Bukele. This article is the core story in Bitcoin Magazine's The Orange Party issue. Link in the show notes if you'd like to subscribe. On September 7th, 2021, El Salvador became the first country in the history of the world to adopt Bitcoin, the world's new currency. Remember those words, as they will be engraved in the history of money. But as of today, in these early times, opinions are stuck in the buckets of it being a bold move, a smart move, a dumb move, or simply a gamble. Of course, it was none of the above. It was the only obvious move, the only logical one. For those who understand, the real question is not if other countries are going to adopt Bitcoin, but when. We are so early in this paradigm shift that a logical, common sense move is controversial. It has many people cheering it on and many, many detractors. On this occasion, I will not analyze the supporters, but the detractors. They can be separated into three groups. 1. The ones who genuinely think it was the wrong decision. 2. The ones who think it's a good decision, but for the wrong reasons. And 3. The ones who are afraid of our decision. Now, the interesting part is that the first and second groups exist mostly because of the third. Why? Because the most vocal detractors, the ones who are afraid and pressuring us to reverse our decision, are the world's powerful elites and the people who work for or benefit from them. They used to own everything, and in a way they still do. The media, the banks, the NGOs, the international organizations, and almost all the governments and corporations in the world. And with that, of course, they also own the armies, the loans, the money supply, the credit ratings, the narrative, the propaganda, the factories, the food supply. They control international trade and international law. But their most powerful weapon is the control of the truth. And they are willing to fight, lie, smear, destroy, censor, confiscate, print, and do whatever it takes to maintain and increase their control over the quote truth, and everything and everyone. Think about the hundreds, if not thousands, of articles about how El Salvador's economy was supposedly destroyed because of its quote Bitcoin gamble, about how we are inevitably heading to default, that our economy has collapsed, and that our government is bankrupt. Most of you surely have seen this, right? They're all over. Every financial publication, every major news organization, every newspaper in the world, all the credit rating agencies, and all the international financial organizations are saying the same thing, as if they were in a choir. But is any of this true? Well, you just need to read their articles and listen to their, quote, experts saying that all of this happened after El Salvador lost around $50 million because of Bitcoin's plummeting price on exchanges. Since we are not selling any Bitcoin, this statement is obviously false. But for the sake of making a more profound analysis, let's say it was entirely true, which of course it's not, but bear with me. Really? A whole country's economy was destroyed by a $50 million loss. Yes, El Salvador is a relatively poor country, but in 2021 alone we produced $28 billion in products and services, pushing the idea that a $50 million loss, less than 0.2% of our GDP, would destroy or even put our country's economy in trouble, is far more than stupid. It is revealing. You would think the economic geniuses at Bloomberg, Forbes, Fortune, Financial Times, Deutsche Welle, BBC, Al Jazeera, The Guardian, The New York Times, The Washington Post, etc., would have enough analysts and editors well-versed in these topics to tell them not to publish that nonsense. You would think these absurd articles wouldn't pass those editorial boards, but they do. And sometimes they even get a very large space, like a full-page spread in the New York Times. So the argument that we have lost $50 million worth of Bitcoin is false, because we simply have not sold any Bitcoin. And even if we were to accept that argument as true, then it would be ridiculous to conclude that an economy of $28 billion per year will go bankrupt or into default because of a 0.2% loss in 1 year. When in 2021, our economy grew 10.3%, or by $4 billion. This is using the IMF's own numbers. And even if you want to accept that absurd argument as true, which would mean you ignore math or basic logic, still, you would have yet to ask yourself why these worldwide media corporations would give so much time and space to such a small country like El Salvador. Were they talking about El Salvador before? Did they care about what happened in our country? Did they report the $37 billion with a B that the previous governments stole from our country's treasury? Ask yourself these questions. A few years ago, did you know where El Salvador was located on a map? Did you know the name of the previous president of El Salvador? Did you know about their failed economic policies? The answer to those questions, added to the incredible absurdity of portraying in hundreds of serious financial publications that an economy that produces $28 billion a year will go bankrupt for a debatable $50 million loss. That is all the proof one should need to see that they are trying to fool you. In fact, these are the real numbers, which are public information and can be found and double-checked quite easily. In 2021, our GDP rose 10.3%. Income from tourism rose 52%. Employment went up 7%. New businesses up 12%. Exports up 17%. Energy generation up 19%. Energy exports went up 3,291%. And internal revenue went up 37%. All without raising any taxes. And this year, the crime and murder rates have gone down 95%. These are the real numbers, facts that cannot be distorted by narrative. The only number that can be changed with their rhetoric is our bond prices, since they depend mostly on the official narrative and the credit ratings of their agencies. More quote truth than the truth. They have said over and over again in more than 100 self-accredited publications that we are not able to pay our debts and are heading for default. We were even ranked as the country with the highest risk of default in the world. El Salvador with more risk than Ukraine. Yeah, exactly. So to counter that narrative, we did exactly the opposite of not paying our debts. We offered to pay in advance. And that is why this month we will be buying all of our 2023 and 2025 bonds that the holders want to sell, of course, at market price. They have also told you that there are huge anti-Bitcoin protests in El Salvador. They have been anything but huge. Furthermore, why would my government have a 85 to 90% approval rating according to every poll conducted in the last year, including several polls conducted by the opposition and several by independent international polling firms, if we were handling things so badly? By the way, what's your president's approval rating? So if you are in group one or two of the detractors, my message to you is this. Stop drinking the elite's Kool-Aid and take a look at the facts. Even better, come ask the people. See the transformations for yourself. Walk in the streets. Go to the beach or to our volcanoes. Breathe the fresh air. Feel what it really means to be free. See how one of the poorest nations in the continent and the previous murder capital of the world is changing to rapidly become the best place it can be. And then, ask yourself, why are the world's most powerful forces against those exact transformations? And why should they even care? You see it now, right? The reason for all of this is because we're not simply fighting a local opposition, or the usual roadblocks any small country may face, but the system itself for the future of mankind. El Salvador is the epicenter of Bitcoin adoption, and thus economic freedom, financial sovereignty, censorship resistance, unconfiscatable wealth, and the end of the kingmakers, their printing, devaluation, and reassigning the wealth of the majorities to interest groups, the elites, the oligarchs, and the ones in the shadows behind them, pulling their strings. If El Salvador succeeds, many countries will follow. If El Salvador somehow fails, which we refuse to, no countries will follow. They know this very well, and that's why they are fighting us so hard. Will you play their game, or will you become aware of the real game? All right, let's take a quick break for our sponsor, and then I want to do a guy's take on this. 99% of what is out there is noise. Swan Bitcoin is pure signal. You know, it's almost a little crazy to say that you would have heard about Celsius, you'd have been warned about Luna and Terra USD, about FTX, about Alameda, before any of them exploded into tiny irredeemable pieces and taking all of your Bitcoin with it, had you been following, listening to, and reading the content and analysis that Swan Bitcoin puts out there. The contrast between the crypto space and the Bitcoin-only companies, between common practices, the mentality, the sense of responsibility is stark. And we just had an awesome conference in LA with the Swan crew, and literally everyone couldn't have been happier in the middle of all of this supposed death of the space. And knowing that I have a Swan auto purchase and auto withdrawal that sends it directly to my keys, I really do not have to do anything. It just runs. Knowing that I have a team that I can rely on, they regularly inform me of things that I'm not aware of. And then I dive into for you guys. You might not realize this, but a lot of what I do on the show, I actually stop and explore because I found out from someone at the Swan team, or I bumped into it on their blog or their newsletter. And then it's like, oh, well, holy crap, that's interesting. I should dig into it. And then I end up covering it on the show. And also knowing that my friends and family who use their service, I have a lot of people close to me who also use Swan. Knowing that there is someone else that I trust for them to answer questions, get help on self-custody, help with their retirement account or their business account at Swan Private, it lets me sleep soundly at night. Not only is my stuff taken care of, but I know I don't have to be the only one to help all of my friends and family. I know I sleep knowing that I have more Bitcoin than I did yesterday, and that when the proverbial fecal matter hits the mechanical air current generator, there is a knowledgeable and principled Bitcoin-only team that I can go to, and that everybody, that my friends and family can go to too. That is Signal. Go to swanbitcoin.com/guy, or you can download their app and just check out what they have to offer. And actually, they've had a few really good pieces on their blog. Steven has a good one on tax loss harvesting, which I'm going to take advantage of. I would advise, if you've been purchasing a lot this year, it might actually be a really good opportunity. So I'll link to it. But anyway, just check them out. And also a huge thanks to Swan Bitcoin for supporting Bitcoin Audible. Okay. So as a natural skeptic, and particularly of governments, politicians, and people in power, and as a libertarian and anarchist, or really a moral abolitionist, because taxation is slavery, and I think slavery is wrong. But coming from that perspective, I do not like holding up or putting on a pedestal someone in power. Now, I have a lot of respect for Bukele for what he has done with Bitcoin. But I also like to stay on my back foot a little bit. I don't like to just take everything said or claimed at his or at their word. Governments are known to stretch the truth or lie, etc., etc. Now, so I come at this article in particular and this situation with that skepticism. You know, sprinkle some salt on stuff. But what's funny is, even trying to look at the situation with a skeptical eye, I see basically what Bukele is arguing. And understand, that even accounts for the fact that the statistics could be exaggerated or biased toward trying to make El Salvador look good. And there's also a note that it's not El Salvador, it's not really whether or not the statistics themselves are correct, because the interpretation of the World Bank and the IMF and these institutions that are downgrading them is to have taken them at their word. You know, if they were saying that all of these statistics are wrong and their situation is actually horrible, that's one thing, because then you're arguing about the reality of the data being spread. In fact, that's the exact opposite of what's happening. They're admitting and posting these very data points and ignoring them, saying that these things are irrelevant to the ultimate discussion. And he has a lot of really important, really good points, like the contrast between how they treat El Salvador and essentially all of these other countries. that are in such a worse condition. I mean, seriously, in the last 2020, 2021, what country do you know that has aggressively grown anywhere? This has been a horrible couple of years, and for pretty much the entire Western world, as well as the many third world countries that depend on the Western world to purchase their exports, which in many cases in the long run is actually bad for their country because they're basically being locked into paying for the deficits of the Western world, and they pay for the U.S. deficit all of the time by, you know, basically siphoning resources out of their countries. But in the short-term GDP return, it's incredibly important. And you see this by watching when the Western world, and specifically the U.S., tightens monetary policy or goes into recession, they get hit 10 times as hard. They're basically monetary slaves. Their economies depend on what the U.S. economy and U.S. monetary policy does, which is all the more reason that they should be looking for an exit. But as we've covered in so many different articles and explorations and Alex Gladstein's pieces and the history of the SIFA nations and the French franc, like so many different situations, you see it over and over and over and over again that the monetary masters, so to speak, the owners of the monetary systems of the world and the owners of the ones in control of the financing, in control of the issuance of debt, it is too easy for them to issue a relatively small amount of money that is a huge amount of money for these small, poor nations, and then rope them into infinite servitude. Never forget, debt is not a gift. It is shocking how hard it is for people to grasp that simple idea, or how little people think about what that means. To be given debt is not to your benefit. More specifically, to be given debt that costs the creditor nothing, that is issued out of existence, is not a gift to you. It's a gift to themselves. When they issue you a $100,000 debt that you owe $100,000 plus 20% back over a period of 3 or 5 years or something, or God forbid, it's like a 10-year, 20-year, 30-year loan where you end up paying $200,000, $250,000. That's an asset for them. That's your liability. They just made you a slave with capital that they didn't even have to begin with. They just made it so that you have to pay them $250,000 that they didn't even have. That's a great deal. Imagine I had that right now, that I could just issue you $200,000 because I've got the right charter and the right permission from the right politician who's my buddy. I issue a $200,000 loan and now you owe me like $5,000 a year. And I have a $5,000 a year income. I didn't do anything. I didn't have anything. I could just be dead broke. All I need is that charter. All I need is the permission to issue money into existence. This is how the, quote, modern financial system and the global credit machine creates colonies. This is colonialization. It's creating slaves through an accounting trick rather than through direct political control. And even better is you create happy slaves because you convince them that they're free. But let's go, I digress. I tangent a little bit here. So going back to my perspective on this is that I do not like to put faith in politicians because, well, I would be an idiot if I did not learn the lesson that has been repeatedly taught to me over and over and basically forever and always throughout history and throughout my personal life. Politicians are generally full of shit and they generally lie about everything. Now, let's look at the stats. Let's look at the data and just try to make an objective idea of how we would think about the future of this country. Absent of Bitcoin, let's not even put Bitcoin on the table yet. So, these are the stats in the article. GDP is up 10.3%. Tourism income is plus 52%. Employment is up 7%. New businesses are up 12%. Exports are up 17%, energy is up 19%, internal revenue is up 37%, Energy exports is up 3,300%, and violent crime is down 95%. Now, let's say all of these are exaggerated somehow, you know, just bias, you know, manipulation of statistics, whatever. The likelihood that all of them are, I think, is very, very low. But let's just say they are. It's still wonderful statistics. It's still hard to come by for any comparable nation right now. Like, literally, if all of those numbers were cut in half, I'd still be like, well, damn, they're doing great. Now, there is one data point that sticks out to me as not being present, is what's the tax revenue and what's the government deficit? So I went and looked it up because I was curious, you know, what it is comparatively. You know, I could even see this amount of growth occurring, this amount of positive outcome in the policies and changes and government actions in the past, you know, couple of years, and then see, you know, a deficit that was like 10x what it normally is, and be like, okay, well, I can at least understand how you could argue that this is, that the statement that they're the most likely to default or go bankrupt country in the world is at least not absurd, even if exaggerated. So the data is actually not super easy to find. It seems like one of the only websites that I found offhand or quickly. I didn't do like a super deep dive, but tradingeconomics.com has apparently pretty decent data on this and a number of other countries, and they specifically have a current account to GDP chart that goes back 50 years, which was the oldest that I could find in a short time frame. So what's crazy is that they actually had a surplus for the very first time in this entire chart in 2020. They had a 0.8% surplus. Now, last year, the latest number that they have is -5%. So they have a 5% deficit, or account deficit in comparison to the gross domestic product. So now the question is this unprecedented? Is this, you know, hugely out of the ordinary? And it's not. It's damn near, like, going all the way back to the late 80s, it's practically average. Like, I think the average is probably like -4. I mean, I'm not going to punch all this crap into a calculator, but you can just kind of see a gradual trend line. It looks like about somewhere between -3 and -5, somewhere in there. Because there are a couple of years that have like -7, -8.5, -7, -5.3, 5.6, you know, that sort of thing. So there are a lot of negatives. It's nothing but deficit across this whole thing until 2020. And now the other important thing to understand about a deficit is how it's being spent. Like, the United States is running a deficit and getting nothing out of it. Almost the entire Western world has skyrocketing deficits and no substantial growth. All they are doing is gaining more dependents, more parasites, and expanding their Medicare and their Social Security and their supposed social safety nets, and endlessly bailing out failing institutions and propping up irresponsibility and corruption. So if you had a deficit like that and the results were negative or static, okay, well, that's an argument to say that they're wasting money. But when those deficits produce a +10% growth in GDP, they produce a 3,000% increase in energy exports, it produces a 95% decrease in violent crime. That's money well spent. That's exactly, if you have a deficit, that's exactly what you want to see as a result of the deficit, so that you actually have a better country and you could attempt to remove that deficit in the freaking future. In my attempt to make this situation look negative, I'm having a really, really hard time. And now we add Bitcoin back into the mix, and it's so inconsequential to the whole picture, to all the numbers. Think about it. This is $50 million is 0.2% of GDP. So if their account to GDP surplus was 0.8% in 2020, it means they could have paid for it four times. And that's if like somebody hacked them and took all of their Bitcoin. This would just be them having four times as much Bitcoin. And if they didn't sell it, okay. And I really want to stress the 95% decline in violence. You can't have a successful country if people are afraid of being robbed, if there's no safety. If you're afraid of being robbed, stabbed, killed, raped in the street throughout daily life. If you were literally the murder capital of the world, I don't care what it costs. If you go from being the murder capital of the world and then you see a shocking 95% decline in violence, that credit rating should go up. Nothing else changes. That credit rating should go up. And there's a point where if the numbers are bad enough, there's just no fixing the violence because you can't paper over an imbalance that big. Now, again, let's put on our skepticism hat and say this number is exaggerated. Well, let's go back to my original point is, let's cut it in half. Well, there is no way to publicly get away with claiming you had a 95% decline in violence if you had a 5% increase. If the homicides and the violent crime, and if it feels no safer for the people, you would never get away with that. Now, maybe you could have a 50% drop in violent crime and then sell it as a 90% drop in violent crime. And the benefit and the comfort and the happiness that came with people feeling safer, you could exaggerate that feeling. You could play it up and convince them that it's actually 90%. But here's the thing. The IMF is not contesting the numbers. They're not saying that 95% decline is a lie or an exaggeration, and thus you should not trust them, thus their credit rating is garbage, thus their country is actually more dangerous. They are saying, they are quietly ignoring the fact that there has been a 95% decline in violent crime, and still saying that the future of the country is bankruptcy and destitution. That does not line up. And as much as I love everything they have done with Bitcoin, and as much as it makes me, you know, want to double down on my laser eyes when he talks about, you know, purchasing Bitcoin in El Salvador, you know, making investment in that way, Bitcoin seems largely inconsequential with the degree of growth and success that they have had. Probably except for tourism and potentially part of their GDP, because there has been a huge influx of, you know, Bitcoiners just, I mean, I know, I feel like I'm the only Bitcoiner who has not been to El Salvador, and I know none of them would have gone otherwise. So it is hard to say that that is even slightly disconnected. That has to be a big part of the increased tourism, but the 95% decline in violent crime would also be a crucial part of that number. Now, the one thing that I think is actually really substantial and really amazing when you think about it in the context of development and sustainability and, you know, creating an independently wealthy nation that has a lot of potential to grow is the fact that Bitcoin has directly subsidized and encouraged, incentivized the production of energy, specifically the geothermal, clean and sustainable, like basically everlasting energy source that they can then export and use to power their own cities so that they are not dependent on some other country or exports from another country, you know, dependent on imports from some other country in for fossil fuels or stupidly for solar panels or windmills that aren't going to actually do anything positive. Geothermal is a great power source, and if you have it available, you should tap into it. And the fact that that actually happened because of a Bitcoin discussion, it was a Twitter Spaces that incentivized and pushed for that exact thing, and that it has happened, that is pretty powerful. And how do you look at a country that is doing that and takes that perspective and is moving that quickly on accomplishing tasks like that and actually seeing results, how do you say that they are not credit worthy? Like, wouldn't those things be the very thing that makes someone credit worthy? like that they are actually producing their own energy, that they are expanding sustainable and positive infrastructure, that they have decreased crime, that they have exceptional growth at a time when very few are experiencing any growth at all, if they are lucky to not be in explicit decline. Remember, credit ratings are only relative. They are comparative to other countries. How could you possibly point out El Salvador in all of the countries around them in Central America, in South America, in the Western world, and say that their future looks worse than many of the others? And for what? Because of $50 million in Bitcoin? Is that it? Is that the deciding factor? And I think this also goes to show the unbelievable lockstep lack of analysis and narrative pushing of the mainstream media. Bloomberg, Forbes, Fortune, Financial Times, New York Times, Washington Post, Al Jazeera, The Guardian, all of them, not only in lockstep sharing the exact same opinion of El Salvador's obvious and clear demise, but aggressively so, and not pushing back against it at all with any real data. Not one of them going, but it is interesting that there is a 95% decline in violent crime. There's something interesting about citizen media and the decentralization of the message that the internet has produced and social media has produced, is you absolutely get an onslaught of conspiracy theories that are highly speculative. You absolutely get mountains of cheap nonsense and meme-level news and versions of stories. But the other thing that you get is real analysis, like hard-hitting, like deep exploration of an idea, because there are people who are just fascinated and want to dig into these things. And I don't see any of that from the mainstream media. The one thing I do see from mainstream media is consensus. Consensus on something that is a lie and that benefits an explicit group of people, but nonetheless, I see consensus. And I think we have come to believe, because we value authority, because the general population believes that authority is really where truth comes from, and they have been taught to listen to who is in charge because they are the quote-unquote trusted source, and that trusted source is a political authority rather than a means of analysis and a way to think about a problem. We've lost critical thinking skills. In fact, it's not really that we've lost it, it's that we've taught it out of ourselves through a really terrible schooling system that basically shoves propaganda into people's heads and gets them to regurgitate it for about 20 years. But because that has become the culture and that has become the general mindset, well, then consensus is the truth. It's not about analysis, it's about who do I go to tell me what it is, and then when the New York Times is the one who says it, and then the BBC says it, and then the Guardian says it, and the Washington Post, well, then that's the truth. Because that's the one that our political systems are going to operate on. That's the ones that the financial system are going to price things according to. And the bonds will respond to. And when money itself is financial, money itself is political, well, then the price does adjust to the falsehood, to the narrative. Because now we can make sure El Salvador doesn't get that loan. Because loans aren't sound money that is lent, that has been earned seeking profit and seeking something with growth potential, but is instead a political issuance of debt that goes from a monetary master to a monetary slave. And I think there's something that Bukele points out in this piece, that there is a very, very important seed of truth in this. Quote, and even if you want to accept that absurd argument as true, which would mean you ignore math or basic logic, still, you would have yet to ask yourself why these worldwide media corporations would give so much time and space to such a small country like El Salvador. Were they talking about El Salvador before? Did they care about what happened in our country? Did they report the $37 billion, with a B, that the previous governments stole from our country's treasury? Ask yourself these questions. A few years ago, did you know where El Salvador was located on a map? Did you know the name of the previous president of El Salvador? Did you know about their failed economic policies? That is a very, very, very important question. Is why do they suddenly care so much about El Salvador's creditworthiness? More specifically, why do they care so much to make it look bad when a general look at the numbers, even considering them greatly exaggerated, is really difficult to frame as anything but really good? Yet juxtapose that with ranking the country to have the highest risk of default in the world. I'm sorry, there is no sensible way to outright dismiss that there is an ulterior motive in that. And I think his last lines are exactly why. I think they know. I think the owners of the monetary system, whether implicitly or explicitly, are aware of their power, and they know how many times they have held a loan over a country's head to get them to do what they want to do, what they want them to do, to get them to enact a policy or move in a direction or invest in something that they sought to bring about. They know the power that they have, whether they admit it directly to themselves and in open conversation, or they know it implicitly by the position that they hold. They know their power is their power over the monetary system. And like Bukele says at the end of this is, quote, "If El Salvador succeeds, many countries will follow. If El Salvador somehow fails, which we refuse to, no countries will follow." They know this very well, and that's why they are fighting us so hard. I think he's right. I think he's right to an extent. I don't think it's a no countries will follow, but I think it's countries that do follow will follow many, many more years later than they would have. And I think the same is actually true of Michael Saylor and companies and major institutions. Is if he fails, then few and or none will follow for a very, very long time. A lot hinges on the outcome of the first people through the wall. And that's actually why I'm glad Bukele, like if you actually look at it from like a pure numbers standpoint, the benefit of what El Salvador did, or what Bukele did in the context of investing directly in Bitcoin, was that they made a very, very loud but small monetarily investment. Like from the context of their position and what is affordable, they didn't put a lot at risk. 0.2% of their GDP is not a, you know, balls to the wall investment. But they did it very, very publicly. And the bulk of their investment was in infrastructure, was in trying to make it a part of the country, trying to make it a part of the financial infrastructure and accessible to their citizens, which has had its own roadblocks. And I don't hear very many good things about the Chivo wallet, that it's had a lot of headaches and a lot of people. I mean, Giacomo, I think, just posted that he lost $8 or something in the Chivo, or $80 or something. I don't know. I can't remember exactly. But from what I've read, that's had kind of mixed success. Like, there are pockets where it's worked really well, and then, areas where it's just kind of like, bleh, nobody really knows about it. They only kind of half use it, and, it shows up very, very rarely, and then, some people have problems with it. So it seems like there's something really promising, but still a lot of work to do on that front. And considering the lack of excitement and the fact that we're in a bear market, kind of makes sense that, it doesn't get a whole lot of attention, and it's seen generally as kind of like a bleh, nothing much happened outside of the communities that have aggressively adopted it and actually understand it and know about the alternatives, etc., etc. But then going back to Michael Saylor again, You know, the fact that these investments are being made with surplus. You know, Sailor, like the thing about MicroStrategy is that they have a lot of profit in an era where so many companies, massive companies, don't even really turn a profit and they survive only because of financing. To have a company that has a surplus and does have a profit and is actually responsible and is actually growing a sustainable business, to see them take that profit and put it into Bitcoin so that they still cannot be controlled by their financing. I think these things have huge effects. And it's also why the behavior and the culture and the perspective, the mindset of those involved, and I think it's why it's so deeply tied to Bitcoin only versus crypto, because could you imagine FTX having this same mentality of, oh, we're only going to invest our profits, oh, we're only going to have a sustainable, profitable business, and we're not going to do anything with the backing funds, so that even if everything goes sideways, like, can you see anybody in crypto really holding that perspective? All I see is yield chasing and token printing, and I'm going to issue a new one, and we're going to have another blockchain for smart contracts that's better than the last blockchain for smart contracts, or interoperates with it, and all you need is this governance stake token. Blah, blah, collateral leverage, blah. Literally nothing about that is robust to me in the slightest. And that's why it doesn't interest me. Because if 1 out of 1,000 survives and just happens to make it through and have like half decent practices and only gets like sort of clobbered by their crypto holdings or investments, it's like, okay, congratulations. But my heuristic made it so that I did not have to investigate 999 giant piles of human garbage in order to find the one that simply made it through the storm. But if Bukele holds course, if Sailor holds course, if the, in fact, Bukele today announced, this was really crazy, today announced that El Salvador is going to be buying one Bitcoin every single day, which again is not a huge investment, but it's such a beautiful, like, we're going to DCA from the heart of the bear market sort of, you know, talk about a vote of confidence. Talk about a throw-it-in-your-face sort of response to the situation. And again, it's so much, it says so much more than the monetary risk involved. He's buying $16,000. It's a country buying $16,000 worth of Bitcoin a day. Like, that is peanuts. It's only a grain of sand, right? A grain of sand a day. But it expresses a mountain of conviction. And Bitcoin only has to go back to like $30,000, $40,000 to get a lot of people to turn their heads and go, that's not working out so bad after all. Especially if they start DCAing again at 16. And suddenly that conviction, that confidence that Michael Saylor and a handful of other companies had and that El Salvador and a few other following countries had, doesn't look so misplaced. Then it goes to 50,000. Then it goes back to 60,000. And in a world where the trust and the narrative is breaking down of the mainstream, another blatant failure in that regard, another blatant and obvious, you could not have gotten it more wrong for the mainstream media, just puts another nail in their coffin and shows that a small country can actually defy the large monetary masters. And all other things aside, I really, really hope they succeed for that reason. But either way, TikTok next block. This gives me more time to stack. I'm not going anywhere. And I know Bitcoin won't go anywhere. It just lengthens our time horizon. So with that, we'll close this one out. Thank you to Bukele for writing this piece and for basically staking so much of his reputation, I guess, on the success of Bitcoin. And for everyone who has. So many of us have gone all in a sense, have put all our eggs in this basket. And that's not necessarily that everyone has put every dollar of their, you know, investment potential, that they've gone all in from a monetary perspective or from their capital and their resources, but that they have staked their integrity on the concept of sound money and challenging the current monetary regime. That's not easy. That's not an easy thing to do. So I salute you. With that, thank you to Swan Bitcoin, to the Fold Card, and to CoinKite and the Cold Card hardware wallet for helping complete my Bitcoin life. This is Bitcoin Audible. I will catch you guys on the next episode. Until then, everybody, take it easy, guys.
I know you're taking it in the teeth out there, but the first guy through the wall, he always gets bloody. Always. This is threatening, not just a way of doing business, but in their minds, it's threatening the game. But really, what it's threatening is their livelihood. It's threatening their jobs. It's threatening the way that they do things. And every time that happens, whether it's a government or a way of doing business or whatever it is, the people who are holding the reins and have their hands on the switch, they go batshit crazy.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.